morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is in the matter of repository technologies. Mr. Terrace.
May it please the Court. We challenge the judgment of the district court in the first instance because it was decided under the wrong standard. The district court decided the case under a clearly erroneous standard, and if the court's review of the brief of RTI, especially on the cross-appeal, might leave the misimpression that there were, in fact, disputed facts. The few briefs tell a somewhat different story. But that is a misimpression. In fact, by way of example, RTI makes much of Mr. Nelson's statements of forbearance. It does not note that it is undisputed that all those statements of forbearance were made after all the money was lent. They might have had some evidentiary value with respect to the recharacterization of debt to equity.
What is at issue on this appeal?
What is at issue is the two things. Propriety of the bankruptcy court's recharacterization.
No, I'm not interested in what you think the legal issues are. I want to know what is at issue. What turns on the outcome of this appeal? I understand that RPI's assets have been sold, acquired by Mr. Nelson. What difference, therefore, does it make whether his loan is subordinated? It seems to me that
it makes
completely irrelevant at this stage.
It is not irrelevant. It is economically moot. RTI no longer exists. Its assets were sold. And in an economic sense, the reconstitution of RTI is really not a realistic possibility. Nevertheless,
then what is at issue? What happens to the legal rights of the parties as a result of this appeal?
The judgment of the bankruptcy court has had demonstrably the effect of limiting Mr. Nelson's remedies for the fact that $3.5 million of value became $475,000 of value.
And I don't understand. Can you be concrete? Who gets, right? This is a case about money. I want to know how much different people's wealth will be as a result of the different legal positions on this case. You see, my problem, it ought to be evident from my questioning, is that it looks like the parties to this case are having a vendetta, and they want to slash at each other as much as possible, but it doesn't look like anything turns on the outcome other than hurt feelings at this stage. I'm trying to figure out what, other than hurt feelings, concretely turns on the outcome.
Two other pieces of litigation.
I'm only interested in this piece of litigation. We will be hearing another piece of litigation in a moment.
And that is precisely what turns on this. That's the only answer I can give to this question. The findings of the bankruptcy court were erroneous and unjustified. They are now.
We don't review the bankruptcy court's findings in the abstract. We review judgments, and only if there is a continuing case or controversy, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. Can you give me a concrete example of something that turns on the outcome of this appeal?
To the extent this appeal is moot, for those reasons the court stated, we believe we are entitled to a vacatur of the bankruptcy court's orders because they're unreviewed and they do have the effect, collateral estoppel effect. That is the point of this appeal.
All right. So you think the only thing that is at issue in this case is the collateral estoppel effect for our second case. And in our second case, Nelson has not appealed the finding that the decision in this case had a particular collateral estoppel effect. So I don't know how a vacator here could change the outcome of the next case because Nelson has not appealed in that case.
Yes, but there's also a case pending in Delaware, also turned on this case, on these findings of the bankruptcy court.
Has anybody, by the way, brought to the attention of the court in either before Judge Koukouras or in Delaware the fact that issue preclusion applies only to findings that were actually and necessarily made in the case, And everybody agrees that the bankruptcy court's finding, although actually made, was not necessary to the outcome. So under classic issue preclusion, there is no preclusive effect.
Yes, and that statement in itself is highly useful, but has not been accepted by the courts that have attended to these other two cases.
All of which shows me that this case is utterly and totally moot.
Nevertheless, we have an adverse finding, adverse to Mr. Nelson, and it is not subject to review, and it is economic mootness. It is subsequent events, and it is precisely in that circumstance where an unreviewed judgment can have far greater effect than a fully reviewed judgment. And that, I think, is the thrust of the rulings of this circuit and other circuits with respect to appeals of cases that have become economically moot for reasons subsequent to the findings of the court. And that is, I think, the appropriate remedy if, in fact, the court concludes that there is no relief that can be fashioned, a conclusion different from that made by the district court, which found, rather, perhaps in a strained way, that some relief could still be afforded, at least with respect to the cross-appeal. So the issue has been addressed below. The district court solicited briefs on the question of mootness. They were submitted, and the district court found, in affirming these judgments, that they were not moot, though Mr. Nelson had advanced that same argument in the district court. So this case does have some vitality, and it is precisely not a vendetta. The fact is that real economic things happened. A business that was valued without dispute at $3.5 million at the end of all these proceedings and events was worth only $475,000. Somewhere in there lies fault. It is Mr. Nelson, of course, who had $2.4 million of debt that lost all that money. So the case is about money. It is procedurally in a very awkward position. And it is awkward in that position because the bankruptcy court made certain findings that were not necessary.
If we were to reverse this judgment, would your client be better off monetarily at all? Would his options be any better?
Yes, his options in court would be much better.
No, his economic options.
Economic options would be unchanged. Well, perhaps there is one outcome that once again would be a litigation outcome. To the extent that his debt was recharacterized and he was awarded nothing in return, were he to become the controlling shareholder of RTI, and RTI might have certain legal rights it might exercise against other parties it cannot now exercise, that is somewhat far-fetched. I think we've mentioned it in our briefs as one possible result, but rather a strange one.
Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, the position we take in other litigation is that the assets and business of RTI, quite a profitable little company, were completely destroyed by breaches of fiduciary duty. RTI, controlled by Mr. Nelson, could assert those claims for its own destruction, so to speak.
So you would have been better off had the bankruptcy judge recharacterized all of the debt into equity.
Well, had the bankruptcy judge awarded anything in return.
But you didn't.
Keep in mind that Mr. Nelson only held 9% of the common equity of the company.
You resisted that throughout the bankruptcy. You resisted the recharacterization.
We did, appropriately so.
You regret that now.
I don't think I'm quite that Machiavellian a thinker, but we don't regret it. That was our position then. It was a correct position then. The concept of recharacterizing advances made by a shareholder only owns 9% and awarding nothing in return is simply a stranger to the jurisprudence on this point and to the statute.
What difference does the recharacterization of the $240,000 have? Isn't that just an academic question at this point? Even if that were incorrectly recharacterized, what difference would it make?
Well, as I say, it makes the theoretical difference that had the bankruptcy court properly joined the other shareholders, I suppose, to achieve this relief, Mr. Nelson at that stage certainly would have been awarded 95% of the stock in this corporation.
On the $240,000?
Certainly. Because the actual shareholders' equity of the company at the time was zero or negative. So What's troubling here is that you have an action for recharacterization and subordination in the absence of real debt other than to Mr. Nelson. You have an effort to subordinate Mr. Nelson's claim to common equity. I don't think you can do that. And when you have an underlying ruling of the bankruptcy court that really doesn't fit into any category of precedent that we can find, you get these troubling results. And these troubling results have, to put it harshly, I think had precisely the effect that the bankruptcy court intended. The bankruptcy court also was aware that recharacterizing $240,000 would achieve nothing and would inevitably result in the dismissal of the bankruptcy case. And the bankruptcy court nevertheless chose to do that, a meaningless act at the time, and chose to make certain other findings not supported by the evidence. And that ruling and those findings have had precisely the effect that I would suspect was intended. Is that a just result? Have Mr. Nelson precluded from his relief and his remedy simply because an erroneous finding was made by a court below? He has a stake in this appeal. He has a significant financial stake in this appeal. Not direct, it is not economic, but it is not a vendetta. Money has been lost for a long period of time. This case is about money and how Mr. Nelson is able to recover it in the future, because he is the only victim of all these proceedings below, and was essentially, if the record is carefully reviewed, completely vindicated by the bankruptcy court, except for this single departure into a realm that the law really doesn't provide for. With respect to the bankruptcy court's finding of the case was not filed in bad faith because a rational reaction, that finding, too, was based on the partial success of the debtor, the recharacterization of the 240. The debtor ought not have had that partial success, and, in fact, is, again, undisputed of record that the issue of bad faith or not was not litigated in the bankruptcy court. The debtor conceded before the consolidated hearing began that if it lost the adversary, the case must be dismissed.
Why did Nelson seek to convert this to Chapter 7?
He did not. I think he sought to dismiss it. I don't recall whether we sought the alternate relief of conversion, but it certainly wasn't pursued below.
But rather than convert to a 7 and liquidate, he filed the suit that ended up in front of Judge Kaur the same day as the dismissal?
That's correct. Mr. Nelson requested that the bankruptcy court grant relief from stay to give him 24 hours to obtain an injunction in the district court. After dismissal of the case, the bankruptcy court denied that remedy, dismissed the case at 4:39 p.m., and a TRO was entered by Judge Kaur at 9:15, and in that intervening period, $170,000 was wire transferred out of RTI. And Mr. Nelson, of course, had a security interest in that cash as well, albeit not a control agreement with the bank. Therefore, he required judicial relief to assert that security interest over bank deposits.
If he had requested conversion to a Chapter 7, the trustee would have retained control of those funds during the time the judge was considering the conversion. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that would have been correct.
And would have had to sought approval of that type of payment.
Same result would have obtained had the bankruptcy court simply granted 24 hours to proceed in a non-bankruptcy court for the same relief. So Mr. Nelson's rights were violated at that moment as well, because it was, and that is not something that is really appealable. It's not in my judgment, but that is what happened. So without being picayune about it, I think that the Judge Kaur entered a TRO at 9:15, and the final wire transfer advice indicates that the funds were transferred at 9:14:40, 20 seconds before. So I don't make much of that. Could have been a day. It's just the coincidence of how that happened.
Counsel, could you raise your voice, please? You're becoming increasingly dim.
I shall. So returning again, what we have here is a decree of the court, and a lengthy one, that reaches a final conclusion that this case was not filed in bad faith, that is completely unsupported. And I think
I don't understand why you think that can be reviewed. We've already agreed it has no bearing on the outcome of this case. And since it had no effect on the outcome of this case, it has no collateral estoppel effect in any other case, right? What you're asking us to do is review something in a bankruptcy judge's opinion that doesn't matter to the judgment. And it's pretty fundamental to federal practice that we review judgments, not opinions.
Yes. However, there are circumstances, and there's one, at least one Supreme Court case, in which a patent was held not to have been infringed and also found to be valid, and the decree was reformed to eliminate the unnecessary finding that the patent was valid, which would cause injury to the party not to have found that infringed it in the first place. So
I can certainly understand an argument to revise a judgment. If the judgment says two things, then one can potentially revise the judgment. But the no bad faith finding is not part of the judgment, as I understand it.
It is not.
The only judgment is case dismissed.
Correct, Your Honor. And the court is correct.
You have any case where we or the Supreme Court have reviewed the contents of an opinion where everyone agreed that that opinion, that the statement in the opinion, did not matter to the judgment?
Yes. And I think the lead case on that is Electrical Fittings versus...
Could you raise your voice, please?
Electrical Fittings versus Thomas and Betts, a 1939 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court at 307 U.S. 241, the case to which I just referred, where the district court determined...
Now, look, I've already told you that that case involved a change to the judgment. Do you have any case where there was no change to the judgment, but the dispute concerned the contents of an opinion?
That case reformed the decree. It did not change the judgment in favor of the
defendant.
The decree
is the judgment in a case, counsel. Do you have any case other than that?
I do not. But the opinion in this case is the judgment.
No, it is not.
Much so is the decree in the previous case.
Look, there are important principles of federal practice, but an opinion is not a judgment.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Terrace. Mr. Welch.
May it please the Court. Perhaps we can start with where Your Honor started. What is at issue in this appeal? I think it's pretty clear our position is that what has been at issue in this appeal is that which Mr. Terrace has identified from Nelson's perspective, which is some benefit or something he attempts to gain in other litigation. But from the standpoint of RTI, it's different. RTI, if there is a reversal the way we think there should be a reversal, with further recharacterization, what happens is RTI's ability to reorganize and continue as a business has a possibility of being reinstated. I believe this court or any court could fashion a remedy that would enable RTI to accomplish that purpose. For instance, Mr. Nelson foreclosed on the assets of RTI. Those assets were acquired by, I believe, his son, and that company is now operating. RTI could get that business back. RTI could once again service the customer contracts, continue to develop its business, and more importantly, reorganize.
Excuse me. Are you saying the results of a sale can be undone?
Yes.
And what is your legal authority for that? We've said, I think, plenty of times that an uncontested asset sale, that is a sale that is not stayed by a court, cannot be reversed. There's even a provision in the bankruptcy code that says that. Now, this was a sale under state law outside the bankruptcy code. But the bankruptcy code is clear that if assets are sold at a sale, it cannot be undone. And our jurisprudence is that that's the same for assets sold under a state law sale.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the way the assets are returned is not necessarily from setting aside the sale. It's from a separate cause of action that RTI would bring to recapture that which has been lost.
That's the same as setting aside a sale. Not.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that
action against whom?
Would have to be against Nelson and the ultimate purchaser of the assets, which was his son, our company controlled by his son. And that business, that opportunity, and the ability to reorganize would be recaptured if that could be accomplished.
Well, isn't Nelson going to be running RTI if you get what you want? If his debt is recharacterized across the board, it's about $2 million or so, which is going to be the substantial equitable contribution to that entity. So he's in charge.
Well, Your Honor, if there was simply recharacterization and nothing further, I would have to agree with you. But we seek not only recharacterization of all of his debt, but then the subsequent equitable subordination of that new equity to all existing shareholders. And I would suggest that if his debt is recharacterized and then subordinated, the other shareholders would be the ones that would maintain control based upon his breaches of fiduciary duty. So, Your Honor, it would be our position that there would be a remedy that could be fashioned if there were to be a wholesale reversal of the district court and the bankruptcy court. Other than that, from the standpoint of Nelson, I really do believe that it does smell of a vendetta by Mr. Nelson to accomplish purposes in other litigation against my firm and myself, as well as against the Emersons in Delaware. That's the purpose of this appeal, period, end of story from Nelson's perspective. And I don't think that's an appropriate use of the appellate process, but more importantly, I think what he really wants to accomplish, and this is where we get to the dismissal order, is to have the language in the dismissal order vacated. That's all he needs. That's all he wants, is to be able to go to other courts and say there was no finding by the bankruptcy court that the Chapter 11 case was filed in good faith. That's all he seeks here today. It doesn't matter to him any longer whether or not the recharacterization is reversed. I believe, as Your Honor pointed out, perhaps at this point in time, maybe Mr. Nelson even realized he would have been better off had the entire debt been recharacterized. But the fact of the matter is what's being done is to use this appeal to accomplish results in the two other cases that we've identified, namely that against Emerson and that against myself and my firm. I believe Your Honor raised a question about conversion and whether or not there could be different results had this case been converted as opposed to being dismissed. I do recall that Mr. Nelson did not seek conversion. He only sought dismissal. The alternative relief he sought was relief from the automatic stay, in that if the Chapter 11 case was not dismissed, the court should lift the stay so he could go and foreclose just as he had intended to do if the case were dismissed. He did not seek conversion. Practical effect of conversion would have been exactly what Your Honor suggested. A trustee would have been appointed who would have taken possession of the business and assets and would have held that business and assets for the benefit of creditors unless and until the bankruptcy court allowed Mr. Nelson to foreclose by having the stay lifted first. That did not occur here. He would have been protected had the case been converted. The loss that he's identified at the seconds before the injunction was entered by Judge Kaur certainly wouldn't have been realized. And Your Honor, those just as an aside, that payment, those distributions were made pursuant to fee allowance orders entered by the bankruptcy court. There was nothing inappropriate about that. Those payments were made before there was any notice to anybody that an injunction had been entered. And although it appears on the face that it was a minute or so before the injunction was entered, it is much longer in time from when the injunction was actually served on those that it would affect. I think it was more like an hour. So I think the result could have certainly have been different for Mr. Nelson had he sought conversion and there was conversion, had perhaps he realized that recharacterization may not have been the worst thing, and we wouldn't be here today except for the fact that at some point he probably would have sued Mr. Emerson in Delaware anyways. The dismissal order, it's a very interesting approach by Mr. Nelson because the dismissal order was never appealed from. Don't know why, but the practical effect of what Mr. Nelson seeks today is really to get the benefits of a success from an appeal of the dismissal order that he never appealed. We are defending the dismissal order here today in the context of the judgment on the recharacterization and equitable subordination complaint. Again, that is the only matter that is important to Mr. Nelson today, perhaps going back to the moment that the appeal was filed. But the fact of the matter is, if he wanted to put the findings by the court with respect to the dismissal order at issue in this appeal, he should have appealed the dismissal order, and he did not. And you can't, through the back door, do that which is prohibited through the front door at this point. I think Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure number 3 provides that if you fail to identify the order that you're appealing from, that is fatal. So why are we here today discussing changes to findings relating to the dismissal of the case when the dismissal order was never appealed from? And I think the answer to that is we shouldn't be. Whatever is incorporated into the dismissal order in the context of, I believe Judge Schmetter's language was, the findings of fact and conclusions of law and his opinion were incorporated into the dismissal order. And as Judge Easterbrook said, the dismissal order simply said the case is dismissed. Regardless of why it was dismissed at this point, whether it was because of the consent by the debtor due to the fact that the court did not recharacterize enough so that the company was reorganizable, or whether it was because there was actual evidence taken on the issues of bad faith and the court found after analyzing that evidence that the case, in fact, was filed in good faith. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the reasons why that order was entered because it was never appealed from. And I would take exception with Mr. Terrace's comments that there was no evidence presented and the issue of bad faith was never litigated. I think it absolutely was. This case was in a kind of a unique procedural posture because of Judge Schmetter's early decision to take the recharacterization complaint and the dismissal motion and combine them together for a single trial. What that effectively did was it created, RTI had the opening burden of proof on the recharacterization complaint, but Mr. Terrace, on behalf of Mr. Nelson, would have had the opening burden of proof on the dismissal motion. What, because of the consolidated hearing, what it effectively did is it put RTI in the position of carrying the initial burden, not only with respect to recharacterization, but also with respect to dismissal. And that's exactly what RTI did. RTI put forth evidence not only on recharacterization and equitable subordination, but also put forth evidence with respect to why the case was filed in good faith. Nelson never at any point withdrew the motion to dismiss, advised the court that it was not proceeding with the motion to dismiss, never advised anybody that he was abandoning his arguments in his motion to dismiss. In fact, in his written closing argument to the bankruptcy court, at the close of the evidence, I believe, I can't remember the footnote, but in a footnote in that written closing argument, he says that the debtor has consented to dismissal if there isn't enough recharacterization. But even if the debtor didn't so consent, there was sufficient evidence in the record to justify dismissal of the case on grounds of bad faith. So even after the close of evidence, and even in the context of his written closing argument, Mr. Nelson was still pursuing dismissal of this case on the grounds of a bad faith filing. So evidence was presented by RTI. None was presented in rebuttal by Nelson. And again, He's stuck with that fact. He may have relied on the fact that the debtor, or pardon me, RTI, had announced that it would agree to dismissal in the event that the recharacterization by the court either was not granted or not granted in a sufficient amount. But nobody knew what the amount of the recharacterization was going to be until the court came out and presented its opinion. And in that single opinion, we have the decision on recharacterization, the decision on equitable subordination, and the decision on dismissal. And it was at that point when we were asked, based upon a recharacterization of $240,000, would we proceed? The answer was no. $240,000 was not enough to permit RTI to proceed to reorganize. So I think the record certainly belies what Mr. Terrace has just said. But more importantly, I go back to my original argument, which is it's in the dismissal order. There's no appeal. We shouldn't be discussing it today. I'm not sure if your honors would like me to address anything further or have any further questions.
Doesn't look like it. Thank you, Mr. Welch. Anything further, Mr. Terrace?
Having the impression that I'm flying into a strong headwind, I will just reiterate one point. I think Mr. Nelson has suffered a ruling clearly adverse to his interests. It is having a present economic effect. He's entitled to have that judgment and order reviewed. If, in fact, it is now moot, then it should be vacated. The fact that other courts may not adopt the position expressed by Judge Easterbrook with respect to the fact that no issue preclusion here occurs, in fact, it has occurred. So there is a demonstrable effect, and to the extent that it is moot...
Mr. Terrace, you are essentially inaudible.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The only point I'll make is that to the extent that Mr. Nelson has suffered an adverse ruling and it has now become moot, he's entitled to the vacation of that order because it has not been properly reviewed and it has an adverse economic effect, which is demonstrable. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.